Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from Florida State University, ranked in the top 20 among national public universities in the latest U.S. News & World Report. FSU specialty license plates support scholarships for deserving students. More on FSU specialty plates is at fsu.edu/mytag. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Local school board members are not term limited, but the Florida legislature may give citizens the choice to change that.
For the citizens of Florida to choose if they want school board term limits.
Also tonight, everybody likes their privacy, but is a new bill keeping much information about state lawmakers secret asking too much?
There are members of the legislature that have been subjected to threats, but I don't know that it rises quite yet to the level that would justify this.
We'll also talk with Florida's resilience officer and find out what state lawmakers are proposing to keep families from going to war when a relative dies without leaving a will. At day three of week three in the 2020 Florida lawmaking session, I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Most Florida state government elected officials have term limits. That includes the governor, members of the House and Senate, and on the federal side, it also applies to the state's congressional delegation. But many local elected officials, including county school board members, don't have those restrictions. A lawmaker is trying to give voters the opportunity to change that in Florida, and we get details from Blaze Ganey.
So far, Claremont Republican Representative Anthony Sabatini has presented his school board term limit bill twice. Both times, he's had to say the bill doesn't actually change anything.
This is actually not a bill that creates school board term limits in the state of Florida. This is a bill that creates a constitutional referendum this November for the citizens of Florida to choose if they want school board term limits in the Constitution, in the state Constitution.
Sabatini says the idea came from polls.
82% of Floridians want term limits in the state of Florida. There is not a single county that polled less than 75% in support, and that's including when you break it down with Republicans, Democrats, Independents. This is just a good government bill.
We don't make policy in the Florida legislature based on polls.
Rich Templin with Florida AFL-CIO says polls don't guide how lawmakers craft the Constitution.
If we did that, there are many issues that have been passed through this body based on the public support for them. Arguing that this high polling right now is justification for passage of the bill would be like when you run for re-election and you get a poll back and it says, oh, I'm polling at 75%. I'll just pack up and go home and wait to get reelected. None of you would do that.
Templin says polls aren't the best way to measure real views on a subject because they lack a forum for discussion.
I have worked on numerous constitutional amendment issues where we start polling at 88%. And by the time the issue passes, it's down to 68%. And that's because there was a discussion. People were given the other side. This was an automated poll. There was no conversation.
Templin believes a better way to measure the bill is to see if it's needed.
And so we do need to ask, what's the problem being addressed here? First, understand that 20 of Florida's most populous counties can have term limits on their school boards right now. That's the bulk of the population of the state of Florida has the option to have term limits by putting it into their county charter right now.
Templin thinks the question should be addressed by each county, allowing local residents to choose whether they want the change. Sarasota Democrat Representative Margaret Good agrees.
I would be in support of amending this constitutional amendment to allow that across all 67 counties and across all the school districts, but I don't believe that this is a decision that we should be pushing forward.
Fort Lauderdale Democrat Representative Bobby DeBose thinks districts should have the option to keep someone past the 8-year term limit.
If you have locally a school board member that has been there, say, 8 years and has done an excellent job, and the voters locally really want that person to stay by 80, 90, 95%, we're telling them no. Locally, you are wrong. We're changing this.
Sabatini, who began serving as a member of the Florida Army National Guard in 2008, says the idea of always changing who leads a position stems from Army practices.
There's a fundamental concept in the military, and that's the rotation of leadership. Rotation of leadership. No matter how good you're doing in any position in the military, any branch of the military, they're going to be moving you around. They don't want you to stay in one position. There's a distrust in that, and over the course of hundreds of years, the military has institutionalized that, and I think it's important to do that in politics. If you're doing a great job, like some of us have done in local government, I see a lot of local government folks on this panel, folks want to move you up, new positions, test your skills in different ways of public service.
The bill passed its second committee Wednesday with no Democratic support. In its first stop, it received a yes vote from one Democrat. Palm Beach Democrat Representative Matt Wilhite co-sponsors the legislation. Florida Republican Party Chair Representative Joe Gruters and Plantation Democrat Senator Lauren Book are sponsoring similar measures. So far, neither Senate proposal has had a hearing. There are 5 weeks left in this year's legislative session. I'm Blaise Ganey.
Well, while we're on the subject of elected officials, since time immemorial, information about public officials has pretty much been exactly that, public. But supporters of a bill that would restrict some personal information about Florida lawmakers want some of that personal data to be kept confidential. We get more on that story from Steve Bosquet.
Florida is known for its strong public records laws, but every year legislators think of new ways to chip away at public access to information. Republican Senator Kelly Stargell of Lakeland has proposed that the home addresses and phone numbers of current lawmakers be kept confidential. She said the political climate in the country is increasingly hostile and confrontational and worries about the personal safety of elected officials.
The animosity, at least from me, and emails and things that I have seen have risen to a higher level than they were even when I first got elected. On Facebook page, the Twitter, just the anger as a whole.
But when Stargell presented her bill to the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee, Democratic Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez of Miami raised objections. He said Stargell has not made the case for such a sweeping exemption to public records laws.
I understand that there are members of the legislature that have been subjected to threats, but I don't know that it rises quite yet to the level that would justify this.
Stargell's bill cleared its first hurdle on a 4-3 vote, with Republicans voting yes and Democrats voting no. But it appears to be in trouble because its next stop is a Senate committee chaired by Republican Ed Hooper of Clearwater, who doesn't like the idea.
The First Amendment's still a fairly important amendment to our society also, and as long as no one crosses that line and directly issues a threat or a promise, then you know, I think everybody's entitled to their opinion.
One of Hooper's objections is that if lawmakers' home addresses were secret, it would be much harder to determine whether they actually lived in their districts, as the law requires.
And frankly, as has been proven in several South Florida elections, that there are times where people have been found not to really live where they're supposed to live. And that would be hard to discover if your home address is exempted.
Hooper chairs the Senate Government Oversight and Accountability Committee. He said he's inclined to not hear the bill this session, which would send it to a quiet death. I'm Steve Bosquet.
Some elderly and ill inmates could be released from prison early under bills moving in the Florida legislature. The Senate Criminal and Civil Justice Appropriations Subcommittee unanimously passed two bills today that would create programs to help clear the way for releasing eligible inmates who are at least 65 years old or those who have debilitating or terminal illnesses. The legislation would require the Department of Corrections to identify inmates who could be eligible for conditional medical release. Elderly inmates would be considered for early release once they reach age 65 and have served at least 10 years of their sentence. Those convicted of murder or a sexual-related offense would not be eligible. The measures considered today are just two of several criminal justice reform bills filed for the 2020 session, with supporters saying change is needed to lower costs to taxpayers and improve inmate outcomes. So far, most have not been considered in the House of Representatives. Still to come on Capitol Report, state leaders are pushing the legislature to renew a grant program they say has been essential to keeping things running as the Panhandle struggles to recover from Hurricane Michael.
There would have been no fire department in Mexico Beach but for this grant program.
Dying without a will can lead to endless court squabbles among the surviving family members. A bill in the Florida legislature seeks to stop that.
Try explaining that to them, that this is property that you've inherited over your lifetime, over your family's lifetime, that your great-grandfather probably got from after slavery.
And the assumption is that the Iowa caucuses will all be held in Iowa, right? But one of them is being held in Florida.
This is the first time there's been a caucus anywhere outside the state of Iowa.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by Cloud Navigator, providing cloud computing services and creating secure and productive workplaces for businesses and government agencies. Cloud Navigator, a Microsoft Cloud Platform partner operating throughout the Southeast. On the web at cloudnav.com.
Governor Ron DeSantis is working to keep Hurricane Michael recovery front and center this legislative session. Regan McCarthy has more.
You know, you look at something like a Michael, and that is something that takes years and years and years to recover from.
But Governor Ron DeSantis says he's pleased to see some progress.
So if you go back to Northwest Florida, I mean, you still see, damage. At the same time, I think the community has responded positively. I think the money we've provided has helped.
Last year, lawmakers approved $25 million for a grant program to help pay for recovery efforts in the Panhandle. And DeSantis says he's hopeful lawmakers will renew the program again this year.
That's allowed us to really help some of the local, the counties and the municipalities that just got socked by all the damages. And even getting the reimbursements for the debris and all this stuff, which is very helpful, you know, you're still in a situation where you have such a small budget and such extensive damage that if we can help fill that hole or help deal with some of the infrastructure needs, we want to be able to do that.
It's been a unique program. In Mexico Beach, we saved the fire department with that grant program.
That's Florida Division of Emergency Management Director Jared Moskowitz. The state sent more than $1 million to Mexico Beach in September to prop up law enforcement and fire department operations. Without the money, Moskowitz says the fire department was at risk of closing. He says the grant program allows the government to respond more quickly as needs arise.
We have a 60-day legislature, but we have problems 10 months out of the year after that. And so things pop up, and by the legislature helping create this grant program, it helps us dole out money, things that are not reimbursable by FEMA. So that's why we're asking for it for one more year, because this is a long-term recovery from the Panhandle from a Category 5 storm.
Moskowitz says the money provided through the grant program is especially needed in the fiscally restrained areas throughout the Panhandle.
The reason why the grant program was so unique is because never before did we have a program that would help cities and counties deal with losses of revenue in order to keep the level of services at the same level. We collect taxes here by houses. If houses are destroyed, if people have moved away, there's a significant loss of revenue. If 3,000 kids are no longer in the school, it's a significant loss of revenue.
Lawmakers are already moving forward with a bill aimed at helping Bay District schools make up for the loss of its students. School funding is generally based on the number of students that attend the school. Several other proposals aimed at supporting Panhandle recovery by offering tax incentives for certain businesses are also moving through the process. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Last year, Governor DeSantis appointed Florida's first-ever chief resilience officer to help the state deal with sea level rise and other effects of climate change. In her first one-on-one interview since she was appointed in August, Julia Nishawa tells Jacksonville sister station WJCT's Brendan Rivers that technology, collaborative efforts, and emissions reductions should all be part of the state's adaptation strategy.
So what is a chief resilience officer, and why is it an important position?
Yeah. Well, you know, it all started with how you even define resiliency when it comes to that ability to adapt to changing conditions and trying to prepare and withstand and recover from disruption. But with regards to this role, it's more of a coordinating role to work with all the departments and agencies to kind of come together. As far as what I would specifically do, you know, to me, some of the key areas is being able to try to catalyze some of the private and federal investments that are needed for our state, trying to obtain funding where we can for various projects throughout the state, working with local officials, working with mayors, serving as an advocate and actually a resource, if anything, to really be able to help cut some of that bureaucratic tape and help accelerate projects where needed overall.
What have you been working on since you were appointed?
I've been traveling all throughout the state, mainly to take stock and inventory on how we can really understand where we are today so we can kind of build on our plans and our strategies overall. So I've been everywhere between Jacksonville, Panama City, Orlando, St. Augustine, Fort Lauderdale, Miami. I was just in Key West. I've got a few more trips that are upcoming, but being able to really take that stock and inventory of what, you know, what are the vulnerability assessments that some of these local officials have been doing. As you may know, there are compacts that have now evolved down. I was just down in Southeast Florida for their compact climate summit. We've got a Northeast one. We've got an East Central resiliency compact that just did a signing ceremony. Being able to work with all those compacts have been tremendous. So I've been putting together, you know, just a long list really right now of what is existing, what are we doing when it comes to resiliency, what are some of those assessments, and really trying to inventory a lot of that that could help build really a list or a repository of best practices and lessons learned at this point in time.
And as you've been traveling around and meeting all these people and learning about what all these communities are doing, is there anything that really sticks out in your mind? Are there any anecdotes that you like to share?
Well, first of all, you know, there's a misconception that it's only just on the coastlines that we have these issues, and we tend to forget there's also other factors like precipitation, inland flooding that we have to also consider, aging infrastructure. You know, the last four hurricanes were all Category 5. We're dealing with stronger storms, and so those preparations, you know, sometimes, you know, the mindset is just, well, if you're on the beach, that's the only folks that we're going to be focused on, and it's absolutely not the case. It's amazing to see there are a lot of similarities and such a willingness, and I think now more than ever, again, with the governor's leadership, you could see it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on politically, everyone has come together as Floridians, really understanding, you know, we're on that point of what those issues are, but rather how can we come up with those solutions? How can we really build upon some of the successes in the past? And, you know, at the same time, understanding it's too expensive to go at it alone, and we really need to collaborate. And it makes the job more exciting to know that you could be part of this and really helping move that needle.
That was Florida Resilience Officer Julia Nishawat speaking with WJCT's Brendan Rivers. When someone dies without a will, their property typically goes to family members. But if relatives can't decide what to do with that property, families could wind up in court, and the judge could place the land up for auction. Robbie Gaffney reports a bill moving through the legislature aims to stop that from happening.
More than half of Americans die without wills, which result in this tenancy in common ownership.
That's Tallahassee Democratic Representative Lorraine Ausley. She's backing a bill to give courts a framework for dealing with so-called heirs' property. That's property inherited by families from a relative who dies without a will. Each heir has equal rights to the land, which is then passed down to their children. As the years go by, the property could have multiple owners from different generations. Attorney Jamie Coleman works with heirs' property. She says no matter how small a relative's share might be, they can force a sale on the land.
Try explaining that to them, that this is property that you've inherited over your lifetime, your family's lifetime, that your great-grandfather probably got from after slavery.
Coleman says when a relative forces a sale, families then have to buy back their land, and if they can't pay, they lose it. Coleman is backing Ostley's proposal because, she says, it forces a judge to give families the right of first refusal.
Procedurally, you didn't have a roadmap, and although judges could ask if other parties wanted to buy them out, there's nothing that was codified in the statute that gave them that type of discretion.
But North Florida Legal Services' Leslie Powell Boudreau says families can already buy out a relative. She worries the time limit set by the bill is too short.
A lot of times, similar to any family law case, time can resolve some of the wounds that may come out of the grieving process of the loss of a relative. And so over time, there's an opportunity for those family members to put their heads together, figure out what the solutions are, and resolve that. And a stricter time process may limit the ability of a family to do that.
Ben Orzeski disagrees. He's chief counsel at the Uniform Law Commission. It's the group that first drafted the act. Orzeski says the bill doesn't limit a judge's discretion to extend a timeline if needed.
I don't think there's anything in the bill that would prevent a judge from doing that even after the law passes if they chose to. We don't take the discretion away from the court.
Ostley's bill passed its second committee meeting. The Senate version is heading to its third committee stop. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
A busy legislative calendar faces lawmakers tomorrow. Here's Gina Jordan.
Here's a look at what's coming up tomorrow at the Capitol. The fine for failing to stop for a school bus that has its stop signal out may double and even lead to a driver's license being suspended. Public notice has to be given for meetings where public business is being conducted. A new bill allows a governmental agency to publish those notices online if certain conditions are met. Since 2012, the Department of Children and Families has been required to contract with the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence for the management of domestic violence services. A new bill takes away that contract requirement. The former president and CEO of the coalition stepped down after refusing to cooperate with the state audit. The audit was a response to her annual salary of $761,000. Licensing requirements may be changing for anyone who wants to be an athletic trainer. All prescriptions may soon have to be electronically generated and transmitted. And finally, Florida's Fair Housing Act may be amended to ban discrimination in rental housing for individuals who need an emotional support animal. That's some of what's happening at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, tonight, the Iowa caucuses will be held this coming Monday, and for the first time, some of those caucuses will be taking place outside the state of Iowa. WUWF's Sandra Averhart recently talked to the organizer of a caucus that will be held in the Pensacola area.
I'm Jim Benda. My hometown is Clive, Iowa, which is a suburb of Des Moines.
Benda, now 66, is a retired attorney who, for the past 6 years, has spent winters at his second home on Pensacola Beach. He will be hosting a satellite caucus where he lives at Emerald Dolphin Condominiums.
This is the first time there's been a caucus anywhere outside the state of Iowa. I'm calling it the first Iowa caucus with a beach view.
According to Benda, the Democratic Party of Iowa approved around 100 satellite locations this year, most of which are in Iowa.
It's places like workplaces, schools, retirement homes where people couldn't get out on a cold night to go to a caucus. But there are also 4 locations approved in Florida.
In addition to Pensacola Beach, remote sites in the Sunshine State include Port Charlotte, St. Petersburg, and Miramar Beach.
My understanding is the largest registration's in Arizona, where there are a lot of Iowans, but there's even one in the Republic of Georgia, not the state of Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, and in New York, and various places where Iowans might be on a February night.
The decision to move forward with satellite caucuses came after initial plans for an online process ended due to security issues. Benda says he got the thought to caucus at his winter home in Pensacola Beach after a friend forwarded information at the last minute.
I literally had 30 minutes before the deadline at 5 o'clock, and I quickly entered my information, and I ran around my building taking pictures of the meeting room and the parking lot because they want to make sure it's accessible. And I submitted the application, and they eventually approved me.
Now, you said that the satellite caucuses will go just like the caucuses in Iowa. Tell us about Iowa caucuses and how they work.
A caucus is a gathering of voters who indicate their presidential preference, and that establishes then how delegates are sent to the state and national convention. It's similar in result to a primary election, except a caucus is a town hall type setting, and you declare publicly, and you have to physically come out and support your candidate.
The Democratic caucuses are based on discussion. After introductions and a tally of attendees, caucus goers split off and the committed ones try to entice their uncommitted friends and neighbors to quite literally stand with their preferred candidates.
An online video explainer from The Guardian.
Those preference groups who gather 15% of caucus goers get to stay. Those who don't have 30 minutes to disband, convince others to join them, declare themselves uncommitted, or take their toys and go home.
If there are in a process like this, it's important to come with the first and second choice. Benda, who's only missed one caucus since 1976, says the event is generally good-natured but can become a high-spirited free-for-all. What's most exciting is that the unexpected can happen, like in 2008 when Barack Obama surged from the back of the pack.
At that caucus, something electric happened. He was clearly the leading candidate, had the most people gathering in his corner. At that point, it was expected to be Hillary Clinton or John Edwards, if you remember him, or even Joe Biden. And it was that electric moment where the candidate who was unknown had really connected with the Iowa voters, with his message and everything else that goes along with making a candidate viable. And the rest is history.
At this stage in the 2020 Democratic race for president, Benda sees former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg as the type of candidate who can gain momentum over other more well-known, well-funded candidates.
I think it's just time for a new generation, and there's just something decent about Pete Buttigieg that means a lot to me given some of the current politics.
If Buttigieg doesn't meet the 15% viability threshold, Benda plans to go with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren as his second choice. At the time of our conversation, at least four people, including himself, had committed to attend Benda's caucus on Pensacola Beach. However, he did not know just how many of the estimated 100 people registered for the four remote locations in Florida will be joining them. The Monday evening event will begin at 7 o'clock. When it's over, the results will be submitted via an app. No matter what happens, Benda says he's proud to be a part of it.
I'm not a party activist in any way, but my vote is important to me, and it's a privilege to be in Iowa and have this chance to have your voice recorded so early, and I'm patriotic about it.
I'm Sandra Eberhardt in Pensacola.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Robbie Gaffney, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Brendan Rivers and Sandra Eberhardt. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox. I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us every weeknight throughout the 2020 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from Florida State University, ranked in the top 20 among national public universities in the latest U.S. News & World Report. FSU specialty license plates support scholarships for deserving students. More on FSU specialty plates is at fsu.edu/mytag.